This is the Tantalk Radio Network.
Hi, this is Patsy with a Z. Welcome to Joy on Paper, a program for writers and those who dream of writing, and for everyone who wants to know the story behind the book. Coming to you from glorious Clearwater, Florida, the perfect place for writers to write and readers to enjoy a good book. And I'm so happy to welcome to Joy on Paper today half of a wonderful, brilliant writing team, Heather Dunn McAdam and Simon Worrell, team up together, husband and wife, as one of the best writing teams in the world. They are just fantastic. They write wonderful books, and this book is particularly touching and heartfelt, and I'm so happy to welcome you to the program, Simon.
Hi.
And Heather's here, too.
Oh, Heather, you made it, too, because you were here for 99.
I was.
And I remember that, and it was such a wonderful, wonderful book, and again, such an important book. So I wasn't sure that you were going to join in. I'm so happy, because this new book called Star-Crossed, it's an amazing book, which you accomplished here. One of the things that I always, when I get to Paris, where do you think is the first place I go to? I go to the cafe. That's my place. And as you can hear, I've got an alarm that says you're going to be on. So I've got to find it. I don't know where it is. This is so bad. I'm sorry about this. I normally have this alarm off. But you are here, so I don't have to worry about it. Okay, so we're going to start again. So I just want to make sure I say your names again so my listeners can hear. Heather Dunn.
It's Dune, like sand dune.
Yeah, sand dune. Heather Dunn McAdam.
McAdam, like the road.
Okay. Heather Dunn McAdam. Okay, that's nice, like the road. And Simon Worrell, that's correct?
Yep.
Okay.
Yep.
And the book is Star-Crossed, a true Romeo and Juliet story in Hitler's Paris. And as I said, I lived in England, and we used to go almost every other weekend to Paris. And the first place we would head is to the Café de Fleur, and we would sit there, and that would be our first, first cup of coffee in Paris.
First croissant.
First croissant. Oh, it was just...
Only 10 euros, right?
Oh, my gosh. When I started back, I moved there like 30 years ago, and I... Wow. There is nothing like that place. It's just something, it gets into your soul when you sit there and you know all of the people who have been there. So, this is such an important story, and it comes at a time where we have a war in Europe again.
Yeah.
And you're telling this story. Now, for me, I have been, of course, as I said, to Paris many times, but I have also been to Poland. I've been to the camps sites. I've been my husband's mother was born in Lublin, so I've spent a lot of time, visiting the camps, going around Poland. So I know, why this story is so important, that people should understand it. I'm sure that you have a way that you want to explain it, who these wonderful people are Romeo and Juliet, and you tell what you want to tell about them.
Well, it all actually began with one of my best friends, whose mother is the sister of Annette Zelman, and she was 12 years old when the Nazis occupied Paris. And so I have sat on the beach for a promised 30 years, and my friend Laurence will say, hello. She comes from Paris every summer. You should write a book about my aunt, you know. And I would say, Laurence, you know, this is just a family story. There's no, you know, it's just family lore. And then one summer, not that long ago, before COVID, she said, hello, my mother, she just inherited a box of books and an art diary from her sister, Annette, from her brother. She inherited from her brother, and her brother had kept this box of letters and art of his sister secret from the family. Whoa. Nobody had seen it. And I said, Laurence, that's a book. So Simon was in England, and he flew to Paris to do a pre-interview. He's fluent in French and German, so he's a very good co-author to have for work like this. And why don't you talk about meeting Michelle for the first time? I mean, I've known Michelle for 30 years, but yeah.
Yeah, I flew into Paris. It was steaming hot day in the summer, and Michelle greeted me at the door.
Oh, I'm sorry. We have an echo. I think, do you have your radio on?
No, we don't have speaker on. No.
But, okay, let's try again. Continue.
I'll turn my volume down. You should turn your volume down.
Is that okay?
Yes.
It was a steaming hot day, and at the door there was Michelle, 92 years old, fresh as a daisy, in a white pantsuit, and she ushered me into a beautiful apartment in Montmartre, overlooking a square, and all over the table were letters, diaries, artworks, and pictures of Annette and her father on the wall, and we sat down, and I filmed her and interviewed her for 3 hours and got the basic introduction to the story, and that's where the journey began.
Oh, wow. Isn't it fascinating how a story can come to you, and then when it comes, this is turned into such a major story with not just having all the letters, but then all the research you did.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
Tell us first about Annette, and tell us who she was and what she did.
So Annette was the eldest daughter of a family of five, and they were her parents were tailors. Her father was a tailor, and they had a family business. They lived in Nancy, which is right on the border, very close to Germany, in the east of France. And you know, during the invasion, they fled. And Annette was autodidactic, very, everybody in this family is so smart. They're really, really great, very vivacious. Michelle is incredible still, and she's in her 90s. Annette, you know, one summer she wanted to act, one summer she wanted to, you know, every time she wanted to do something, it was always artistic, but she decided she wanted to be an artist when they fled to Paris, and she got into the Beaux-Arts, and almost immediately became a regular at the Café de Flore, and she was 19, she was young, vivacious, loved to go dancing, and in the midst of the Café de Flore scene, there was a love triangle, there were a few love triangles, but she dated Jean Rouch, who is a very famous documentary filmmaker, or would become one, and then she was simultaneously in love with Claude Croutel and Jean Josselin, and they were both Gentiles, which was an issue for her family, but she ended up with Jean Josselin. Fell madly in love, head over heels, and he was, Simon, why don't you speak about Jean? That's sort of how we divide things up.
Yeah, Jean Josselin was a young, only child of a very severe Catholic parents, a doctor, and he was a young poet, a Dadaist. He had a magazine called The Reverbère, which means the street lamp, and he fell madly in love with, he was sort of petite, very elegantly dressed, always with a silk handkerchief in his breast pocket. And he was a regular at the Café de Flore as well. And, you know, they became acquainted with Simone de Beauvoir, who wrote very movingly about them both when Annette disappeared. So that was Jean Josselin, and that's where their love story began, at the Café du Clos.
We did a lot of field research. We took Michelle to the Café du Clos, and she pointed out where Jean and her sister sat, and across, you know, where Simone de Beauvoir and Jean-Paul Sartre sat. And, you know, there is the wonderful red blankets. We sat there and we wrote and sort of tried to channel 1942 Café du Clos while we were writing in the cafe. But it was really wonderful to be there with Michelle. And, you know, she was a kid, and she used to come into the floor and pick up her sister for dinner. Mom wants you to come home. And she would get introduced to Simone and Jean-Paul Sartre. And then they would all go back to their apartment.
Well, you know, for people who haven't been to Paris, the floor is a place where you gravitate to. It's almost a pilgrimage because it's been there since 1877. Everybody who is anybody has gone there at least once. And it is exciting when they point out who sat where. And you do, if you're a writer like me, and like you do sit there and you do hope that maybe one of them will, you know, inspire you, because it is a magical place.
It is. Yeah, there's such wonderful history. I mean, one of the people that I found in my research was a beautiful model, one of Man Ray's muses, and her name was Sonia Mose, and she sat in the at the table of lesbians, and she was very good friends with Dora Maar and Picasso, and she was a beautiful, beautiful Jewess, but she was blonde and very curvaceous. She had did surrealist art as well, and she has a very tragic aside story, you know, being picked up and dying in Sobibor. And one of those empty seats that Simone de Beauvoir writes about.
Well, explain to my listeners. I mean, we're talking here about a Romeo and Juliet, and it's also a story about Jews and Christians, because there was this, you know, I don't know, even today probably there's some people are like question the relationship, but not anymore. You know, it's so ridiculous because,
well, it was such a big deal then, because what happened was that you know, one of Jean and Annette's best friends, his girlfriend, was arrested, and she had been a best friend of Annette for a while. They had had a falling out, but she was arrested because she was Jewish, and they said that she was like a foreign national. And so she was thrown into prison, and the roundups were starting. This is 1942. So the first transport to Auschwitz of young women has already happened, and the first transport of Jews, which was all young women, which I wrote about. But so 1942, they're starting to round up Jews in Paris, and so you know, we sort of guess that Jean Josselin and Annette thought the best way to save her would be get married and give her his name so she wouldn't be Zelman. And so the moment they publish their marriage bans, their plan to get married, Annette is arrested, and they, within 24 hours, a law is passed that it is illegal for a Jew to marry a Gentile, and because of that, Annette becomes a political prisoner and ends up in Auschwitz.
I'm not going to give the story away because it's a key thing, but she's betrayed by somebody very close to them.
Well, there's
no plot spoilers,
there's betrayal, there's cruelty, we have all the documentation, and the terrible thing is the Nazis kept such records that you can follow along what happens to people. What horrible, you know, you did this in the previous book, and it's the same thing, how you face the horror of really of your research, but I'm sure the family now is happy that you have brought this story out.
Oh, they actually thought that Annette had died the day she arrived in Auschwitz, and of course I knew that wasn't true, and I corrected the archive in Yad Vashem, but because of my research, I'm pretty tenacious, I'm like a pit bull when it comes to trying to get to the truth, and I was actually found, a testimony that reported that Annette was alive in August 1942, and she was with her friends. Because I've written about Auschwitz, and this is my third book now on the subject. Writing about Auschwitz, I know every corner of it. I know it really well, and I can do it. Very, it's not easy, but I can do it. What really got me in this book was writing about the prisons in Paris, which I had never been to emotionally or psychologically, mm-hmm. and writing about the depot and Les Tourelles because we know what's coming, and we have Annette's letters from those prisons, and she writes about how horrible they are, and we know that she's about to end up someplace that is so much worse. And that just really, really tears me up.
I know it's also heartbreaking. And it happens. When you're in a place like you're in Vienna, and it's so civilized, and it's so beautiful, and the opera is so great, and the theater is so great, and the museums are so great, and the churches are so beautiful. And then, as you're sitting there at a corner cafe, and you're looking out, and you're saying, "In 1940." This place was hell.
Yeah.
And it's very hard to comprehend.
Well, where we stay in Mamapa, I'm going to give a shout out to my dog, because you may go to Cafe Flore when you arrive in Paris, but we go to the dog park at Sacré-Cœur, and my dog knows the way up to, I can get lost. Mamapa is maze, and I'll be like, oh, where am I? And Dylan is like, up, and he knows exactly where all of his friends are. He has friends in Paris, he has friends in Madrid now, too, but he's an international traveler. And as you walk through the streets of Montmartre, which was the Jewish quarter, the large Jewish quarter in 1940s, you'll see plaques. And there's one plaque that is just a couple of blocks away from where Michel Keres lives. And that plaque is a children's school. And it tells you over 500 Jewish children were taken arrested and gassed sent to Auschwitz. So there are plaques in Montmartre that memorialize this, and it is pretty stunning, to walk down streets today and see that information, and then read the history, the actual accounts of being rounded up and ending up in the Velodrome, and which was a horrible, horrible experience that we do cover in our book.
And of course, one of the things in this book, you have a lot of references in the back, and I think it helps put things in perspective. Let's talk just a little bit about Jean.
Yeah, as I said, Jean was a young poet. They fell madly in love. It's called Romeo and Juliet because both sides of the families were against the union. Anne's family less so, and they eventually came to accept Jean. He became part of the family, really, and pretty much disowned his own father, because his father was an anti-Semite of the First Order, and he was vehemently against the idea that his only beloved son would marry a Jewess, and he hoped it would all blow over. And then, of course, Annette disappears. Jean visits her in Paris in prison. And there's very, very moving letters from Annette to Jean asking him to bring books, John Dos Passos, among others, and chocolates and some new underwear and all of that, daily necessities. And then she disappears and he's left stranded. He goes down, the parents have moved to Limoges, which was in central France, more friendly to Jews. He goes and stays with them. He starts to write a novel. But he's in limbo, basically, dreaming of Annette. Still lives in the studio apartment where they first made love, and she's got things still there that reminds him of her. He's heartbroken in limbo. And then the minute that the Allies march into Paris, Leclerc and Patton's army, as Patton's army heads east, Jean pops in a Citroën Maigret's car, you know, the famous Citroën with three other journalists, and heads east towards Germany, Poland, to rescue Annette, he believes.
Well, the way you write the story, the way you lay it out, you also have included some photos, some drawings, of course, some poetry, and you tell the story in such a touching way. So we know the end of World War II, but we, along the way, you managed to build up the suspense of what's going to happen and how things are going to turn out. And as I said, because along the way, they also face not just the anti-Semitism, but also just this part of war where you can't trust anybody and you don't know who will turn you in, who will tell somebody about you. So you build up that suspense, which makes for the book an exciting read.
I really
think it's great. And, you know, I think when you have an important book like this, I want to encourage my listeners. Sometimes you think, well, I know about it. I know about World War II. I know about what happened. But I'm telling you, in Star-Crossed, we have such a carefully and beautifully written book that really lays it out. And because it touches your heart so much, and it will make you think, and particularly now when we know that I cannot get my arms around a war in Europe, a ground war in Europe with tanks and battlefields. I get so frustrated by it because there are more, Russian and Ukrainians who used to be intermarried or are intermarried or wanted to get married, and they're facing this kind of thing.
Well, and I just want to reference 999 here because Edith Grossman, who was on the first Jewish transport to Auschwitz and was 17 when she ended up there and was there when Annette arrived, she famously said, war serves no one. You know, everybody loses kids, loses property, loses, lives and income. It serves nobody. And now with climate change, a war is the worst thing that can happen to humanity anyway. Now it's even worse because we don't need to be creating more carbon, which a war is a huge carbon maker. I think that's one of the reasons. I mean, I have had people go up, to Edith in synagogue and say, well, I know I'm not going to come hear you speak because I know all about the Holocaust. And Edith used to say, really? Because I was there and I don't know everything.
Exactly. And I think that you bring these two characters to life, give them life.
Well, I think that's what's so important in this work, is if we can individualize the work, if we can personalize it, then you no longer, 6 million is really hard to get your head around, right? But if you know that this beautiful, young, vivacious woman who loved and created art and laughed, I mean, Annette is really funny. The first half of the book is captivating and hopefully really hilarious. I mean, she loved to pun. She did really silly things. She has these, torrid love affairs. She's a complete mess. She's just adorable. You love her.
And obviously very, very talented, because you don't get into Beaux-Arts unless you are fantastic and you have talent. So you make this connection to her that is very strong. And people, when you read this story, you will never forget Annette, and you will think about it. And when you go to Paris.
I miss her. Yeah. When we finished the book, I looked at Simon like a week later. I was like, I'm missing that. You know, like I spent like 2 years with her, and I get teary just thinking about her. I mean, I just love her. I would have just loved to know her. And Michelle, her sister, is, you know, we had a lovely, at Christmas, we were in Paris visiting Michelle, and she has identical twin daughters who were born on her birthday. And let me just say that Michelle is turning 95 tomorrow. So it is her birthday and her daughter's, her identical twin daughter's birthday. But we were there at Christmas, and her daughters, who are very, very petite, très, très petite, they put some music on and said, Mama, we dance for you. And they start dancing with their husbands, doing swing, and Michelle is clapping and laughing. I mean, it was just so charming and French and lovely.
The spirit of Annette is in them.
Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely.
Well, I want to tell you, your book is terrific. Everybody, you can get it. It's online, and I'm sure in the best bookstores will carry it, because it's a beautifully written book by two very talented authors. So do you have a website?
We do. You can. Best is heatherdoon.com. That's super easy. And I also just want to mention, while I don't know the date yet, I think I'm going to be appearing at the Tampa Jewish Film Festival.
Oh, wow.
There is a French TV movie out called The Case of Annette Zelman, and I am doing some speaking gigs, and hopefully I'll be down in the area signing books at the local bookstores for a day or two, and speaking about the research in conjunction with that French movie that is playing at the Tampa Jewish Film Festival.
Wow. Okay. Well, I might see you there. I usually go.
Oh, great. That would be wonderful.
Before the pandemic, I always went, but, you know,
right.
So this will be the first one since the pandemic ended that I will attend, but I'll look for you, okay?
Please do.
Okay.
Wonderful.
The name of the book is Star-Crossed, A True Romeo and Juliet Story in Hitler's Paris, and it's not only is it beautifully written, but all of the research that they've done, they put into it. It's at the back of the book, and I think it will give you some ideas, both of the depth of the book, the writing, but also if you have a family story that perhaps somebody's, you know, saved up some letters and books that might one day turn into a book for you. So, again, thank you both for being on the program, Heather and Simon. I think you're fantastic authors, and I'm very, very proud to help promote this book.
Thank you so much.
Thank
for the
you
shout
very
out.
Much.
Okay. Bye bye now.
Shalom. Bye.
Shalom. Bye. Okay. Wow. As she said, this Annette was a terrific person and absolutely fascinating read. So we're going to have a book buzz and then commercials, and I'll be right back with my next guest.
Hello, fellow mystery lovers. This is author Rita Moreau reporting for Joy on Paper with a mystery that will keep you turning the pages. Carol J. Perry's Now You See It. Sometimes 13 is a lucky number, and for fans of Carol J. Perry's Witch City Mystery Series, it is, with this latest installment that features Lee Barrett, the program director for Salem, Massachusetts, local station WICH-TV. In Now You See It, Lee and her husband, Detective Sergeant Pete Mondello, are settling into their new home. The honeymoon is over, and Lee is back on the job as program director for Salem's WICH-TV, recently promoted to historical documentary chief executive. Her first project is to promote Salem's new international museum. Seems easy enough. She loves looking at their collection and doing research about Salem's long-ago days as a shipping capital. That is until the driver of a truckload of antiquities turns up dead. Soon, Lee and Pete are dredging up clues along with a hardy crew of helpers. Aunt Ibby, a former librarian, offers her advice, while a local practicing witch, River North, has some ideas too. And of course, Orion, Lee's clairvoyant cat, has his own ideas. But when a ship motto in the exhibit's collection appears to be haunted, Lee will have to dive into her own treasure trove of psychic gifts. For author Carol J. Perry, juggling details and coming out with twisty plots is her specialty. After all, she was born on Halloween Eve in Salem. Special thanks to Kensington Publishing for another great cozy mystery. Pre-order Now You See It by Carol J. Perry and expect the unexpected in a mystery that features a memorable cast of characters and lots of page-turning fun. This book will be released on September 26, 2023. Now You See It, book number 13 in Carol J. Perry's Witch City Mystery Series, is available online. This is Rita Moreau, author of the Ghost and Camper Cookie Mystery Series, reporting for Joy on Paper. For more of my suggestions, go to our website, www.radio-joyonpaper.com. Buzzing off for now.
This is the Tantalk Radio Network.
Have you ever faced disaster? The Red Cross is always there for you. The Red Cross responds to a call for help every 8 seconds. They have never turned anyone down. Now they need your financial support so that they can be ready to help you when the need arises. Donate online at redcross.org. Thank you.
Are you an author, an artist, an inventor? Then you need to protect your valuable intellectual property. You need Larson & Larson. We have the experience and knowledge to help you with all of your legal needs, from processing trademark, copyright, or patent applications to negotiating licensing agreements and handling litigation. The attorneys at Larson & Larson in Largo, Florida can help protect you. Call us today for a no-cost consultation at 727-546-0660 or visit our website at LarsonPatentLaw.com.
Do you dread being called on to speak at meetings or family functions? Have you envied those who can sway an audience with well-chosen words? Do you know that people who speak well earn more money, earn more recording careers? Gain the confidence to master any speaking situation. Toastmasters will allow you to find your voice. Go to Toastmasters.org to locate the club nearest you.
This is the Tantalk Radio Network.
Hi, this is Patsy with a Z. And I am back, and I'm so happy to welcome to Joy on Paper Lincoln Child, and he is the co-author of a wonderful book called Dead Mountain. And this is a series written by him and by his fellow writer. And, you know, one of the things I love about writing is that sometimes when you find the right partner, it really works out. And in this series, it's by Preston and Child, and this is the fourth book in a spin-off from the original series, and this one is fantastic. Hi, Lincoln.
Hi, Patsy. Can I call you Patsy?
Oh, absolutely. I'm so happy that you're on today because, of course, I love Douglas Preston, and I love this series. You know, for me, archaeology is like, you know, it's a go-to subject for me. I just love books about archaeology. And in this series, this is book four in the Nora Kelly series, which is a sort of offshoot of the Pendergast. I don't remember how many books there are in that one. How many?
Oh, countless. Probably 25.
Something like that. But and the first, I remember when the first book came out of the Nora Kelly, and that one was the Donner
Right, old bones.
Old bones. Yeah. And yeah, and I, when I was a child, for some reason, someone must have scared me to death about it. And I always had a horror of just the subject. But I love the characters in this book, and I love the way that you two write. You're very simpatico, aren't you?
Well, you know, it's funny because we met back in the prehistory, back in the 80s, when I was a book editor at St. Martin's, and he was one of my authors. And he did a nonfiction book for me about the Museum of Natural History in New York. And we bonded and became friends and wrote a thriller called Relic, which we made into a film, which Pendergast was a bit player. But pretty soon we realized what we had, and now he's been in 25 books, and he's hit them number one spot on the list several times, and we just got very lucky. But in this particular case, Old Bones and the entire series, the Nora Kelly series, it spawns from a book called Thunderhead, which is a thriller we wrote about the ancient Anasazi and a city of gold they supposedly had hidden, and it starred Nora Kelly solo, because both Doug and I love archaeology. My grandmother was an amateur archaeologist, and he lives in Santa Fe, and so he's ridden on horseback thousands of miles, and he can add all the local color. So when it came time for us to add another series, you know, we took two characters, a young FBI agent, just still being ghosted, meaning that she has a senior agent who's making sure she's fit for the job, and Nora Kelly, this archaeologist at the Santa Fe Institute. And so the two of them work hand in glove. If there's a crime that requires certain forensic archaeology, Corey Swanson, the FBI agent, calls in Nora, and if Nora finds some weird bones, she calls in Corey Swanson. And we've managed to work in a lot of historical mysteries, like the Donner Party, which you mentioned, which also scared the hell out of me when I was a kid. And in this most recent book, we took a story Doug wrote for The New Yorker, which was an unsolved mystery also, and transplanted it to the Manzano Mountains of New Mexico.
And, of course, it involves Native Americans, and one thing I will tell you, again, you know, with the Donner Party, I had sort of the creeps, but this one, where we're in a cave, I got the way you wrote it so well, I felt almost claustrophobic that I was in this cave. I wanted to get out of there myself.
Well, good. We're doing our job right then. You know, we really try and we write thrillers. We write thrillers that we would like to read ourselves. You know, that's our mantra. If it wasn't fun for us, we wouldn't do it anymore. And I have a horror of subway trains, especially the New York Express on the East Side, which goes way deep, and you know, goes for miles between stations. And so I was careful in one book to write a scene where that thing stops and the lights go out, because I thought, you know, if this gets the heck out of me, I can probably scare a lot of people too. So I know the scene you're talking about in the cave, and, you know, I feel claustrophobic in caves. And so I guess my own feelings, I'm able to transmit it to the page, you know, which is a good thing, I think.
Well, you certainly capture the feeling. I tell you. I was like, get me out of here. Of course, the story, do you want to explain what the story revolves around?
Yeah. I'd be happy to. The background is that Doug, as I mentioned, wrote a New Yorker article about something called the Diablo Pass Mystery, which took place in the 50s, where about eight or so very well-equipped and experienced young winter hikers were going to go up and take this journey along the ridgeline of these mountains in the then Soviet Union. And there was a big blizzard, but nobody was worried because these guys were experts. But when they didn't hear from them, they sent a search party out, and they found out that there were all their snowshoes lined up in front of their tent, and all the food inside, you know, all prepared. But for some reason, they had blasted a huge hole in the side of the tent and run out. Some with very few clothes on, some almost naked. And they had frozen to death, running away from something. And a few of the bodies weren't found until the spring after the snow melt. And they had even more things wrong with them. I don't want to.
Yeah, don't give it away. But boy.
But they never solved it. There were people said it's a Yeti. People said it's Elvis. People said it's aliens. You know. But they never solved it. And so we decided to transplant that story to the Manzano Mounds of New Mexico, which Doug knows very well, and make it completely our own, and also solve it, which we did.
You did. That's for sure. I love the characters. And of course, you've introduced a new character here. But I like Corinne Swanson. Corey, she appeals to me. There's something. I get a kick out of her.
Thank you. You know, that character was originally based on one of Doug's daughters, because when she first appeared, she was a young goth in Kansas rebelling against everything that didn't fit in, and he needed his daughter to say what kind of music she'd be listening to and things like that. So he has sort of a sentimental attachment there from the beginning, and she, under the help of Agent Pendergast, grew into a great character, who's now in the FBI, and a very strong woman character too. You know, so that's what we like about the series. We have a very strong archaeologist in Nora, and a very strong, if younger, new FBI agent in Corey. And watching the sparks fly when they come together, they have a friendship, but it's a slightly brittle one. You know, it's a lot of fun for us. Show these two strong women.
And a lot of fun for the readers. I love the dynamics between them. As I said, Corey, just something about her, I think from the first time I, you know, started reading about it, there was just something, something, and it is because it's based on his daughter. He puts that little bit of extra in there in her personality, so she has room to grow.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, we didn't know she was going to grow. We thought that book was a one-off because Agent Pendergast is never in Kansas. But we thought we'd put him there as a fish out of water to try a case out of New York. But Corey disappeared, you know, and made herself known. I mean, she stole all the scenes. And so she basically... barged away into our multiverse characters.
Isn't that fun when a character takes over?
Yeah, they have a funny way of doing that, you know, and you never know who's going to do it and who's going to recede in the background.
Well, it certainly works here, and the entire story about, you know, the Manzano Mountains and all of this mystery is fascinating. And you, as I said, you're introducing a new character, I think, right? In this
well,
one?
Yes, we are. Well, this, yes. There are, Corey has a new, what they call a mentor in the FBI, because the last one met his untimely demise. And we like this new guy a lot. You know, we like to play against type, so he's not the usual FBI agent with the, you know, Hickey Freeman button-down look. And so we're very happy with how he turned out, Clay Sharp, and are looking forward to seeing more of him in the next correspondence book, because there are going to be three more, at least. Unless we break our contract, which we don't want to do.
Or if the two of you get in a fight, Dean Martin and Jerry Lewis.
It's like a bad marriage sometimes, you know, but we've been writing since the 80s, and we've learned to respect each other, and well, we do respect each other. We're great friends, and, you know, the hardest thing for a writer to do is some criticism, especially if somebody who is not their editor, who's paying them, you know, but we've learned to check our egos at the door, and we you know, when we started out, people didn't like the idea of two authors writing fiction together. You know, it seemed odd and it, like, wouldn't work. And they wanted to use a pseudonym for us. But we learned right away the best way to work. And what it is, we each take a character or a sequence or a subplot, and we write that. So there's, and we take like a literary Zamboni over the whole thing afterwards to smooth it out. So that ideally readers can't tell who wrote what.
No, we can't, but we know that the writing is great. It's really compelling. The story is compelling. The characters are, as even from book one or from The Pendergast, they develop in such a nice way, and they become friends. We really care about them.
Thank you. That means we've done our job, because we care about them, and so I'm so pleased to hear you say that. Thank you.
Well, I think it's a wonderful series, and everybody, this book, you can read this alone, but I know if you read this book, you'll want to go back to the beginning, and that's the wonderful thing about the internet now, is that you can go back and do some binge reading, and this is a wonderful series. It's lots of fun, and you learn stuff along the way, too. I love always learning both about FBI techniques and about archaeology, which apparently you two love to do the research that goes into it.
Yes. You know, I was, I said, an editor, and so I know that there's good research and bad research. And the bad research is when somebody writes an Elizabethan novel and says, I took 2 years to research this, and you're going to learn everything I learned. I'm going to cram it all into the book. And, you know, that's disastrous. You know, we try and pick a subject that we like archaeology or natural history or code breaking or whatever it might be, and teach the reader a little bit about it over the course of the book. Not so much that it becomes your eyes glaze over, but integrating it into the story in such a way that it's learning about it as the heroine or hero learns about it is hopefully an interesting, you know, process.
Well, that's the way you do it, and it is nice. Exactly what the way you said it, that you just put in enough to keep it different from anybody else and keep it interesting, and the books move along very nicely. It's a great book, and I want to thank you so much for being on the program today. It is called Dead Mountain, and it is available wherever books are sold. It's by Douglas Preston and Lincoln Child, and you have a website you want people to go to?
Yes, actually, two, if I can presume.
Sure.
The first is www.PrestonChild.com. Just our two last names. And the other one is www.LincolnChild.com, which is my full name, where I have my own series of Jeremy Logan books, who was a supernatural sleuth, present day. But, you know, it's a genre that hasn't been mined very much since the 20s. And he's developed his own following, too. So those are the sites you go to learn more than you could ever want to know about our book.
And everybody, get Dead Mountain, book number 4 in the Nora Kelly series. It is a wonderful book. You'll have a lovely weekend if you just sit under a tree, in a hammock, on the patio, next to the pool, and read Dead Mountain. Okay?
Thank you so much for having me. This has been a pleasure.
Well, it's been a pleasure to talk to you. Lincoln, thank you very much for joining me. Lincoln Child is a fantastic writer, everybody. Get this book. Bye-bye now, Lincoln.
Bye.
Okay. Oh, I love this book. I love archaeology books. I love any books about archaeology, actually. Although I can tell you, I don't think I could do this cave dive. I like outdoor archaeology where I can just dig in the sand. And I've done that in Israel, in Iran. I've done outdoor archaeology. And even in England, in, near the border, near Hadrian's Wall, between England and Scotland, I was on a dig there. But I'm an outdoor... I'm not going to go in a cave. You're not going to get me in a cave. You can barely get me in an elevator. So, yeah, definitely. But anyway, I want to, again, thank a special thanks to both Heather Dune McAdam and, of course, her husband, Simon Worrell. They are fantastic writers. I do hope you get this book. It is, as I said, Star-Crossed Lovers, A True Romeo and Juliet Story in Hitler's Paris. We know, you know, there's going to be problems, but I will tell you, the character of Annette is written so well, you will just want to get to know her, and you will want to actually go to Paris, I think, after reading this book. So do get that book. I forgot to tell everybody, I think I had to move Bill Larson, but he's going to be coming on next week. And if you have questions, AI is driving so many people crazy. And if it's driving you crazy, Bill Larson will answer your questions about AI as it goes about intellectual property. They're telling me now in Hollywood, a friend told me that they're actually going to write scripts by AI. They're crazy. They're insane. They're insane. I'm telling you, I hope that whatever they do in Hollywood, I'm, you know, picket lines are picket lines, but boy, oh boy, this is insane to have them writing scripts. When you're a script writer, if they want a script, I'll write it. You know, give me a chance, but not AI. Please don't do AI. It's ridiculous. You know, I don't think any AI can be as silly as I can be in a script. I can write really silly scripts. So think about hiring me before you hire AI, you stupid studios who are thinking about it. Anyway, it's been a fun day today. Sorry about the alarms. I don't know what. This phone is driving me crazy. It goes on and off and on and off. And it updated today. That's why this happened. It updated. You know how long it took to update this phone? I was like going crazy. Anyway, what I always tell you, people, thank you for your emails about the books you're writing. I do want to tell you, I'm going to have an editor on, an active editor, who's going to be talking about writing and how to edit your book. So I'll have that announcement next week. Meanwhile, remember what I always tell you. One of the joys of life is to see your words on paper or to hear them spoken in an audible book. Or if you're very, very lucky to hear those magic words, lights, camera, action, and your book will be turned into a major motion picture, streaming video, or perhaps a series on the Hallmark Channel, like we are hoping for Carol J. Perry. Her Haunted Haven series, which is set here in Florida, would also make a wonderful series, because I would love to have a film, streaming video, or whatever, filmed right here in our backyard. Anyway, say something nice to somebody today. I will say something nice to Big Ed in the control room. Thank you, Big Ed, for everything. He saluted me. I saluted him, because I should have been a general. Oh, boy, oh, boy, oh, boy, would I have been a great general. Everybody, bye-bye now. Have a great weekend.